seated. Now, I want to advise council that Justice Marquez will be joining us on December the 13th. She will participate in these cases by listening to the tapes and reading the briefs. Justice Malarkey's term officially ends at midnight tonight. Justice Bender will be sworn in as Chief Justice in the morning. So if you have cases coming up Wednesday and Thursday, he will preside. So as you present today, please introduce yourself and who you're representing. And we'll take a break after the first argument. Counsel? The first case is Upper Yampa Water Conservancy District versus Wolf.
May it please the court, I am David Halford from the law firm of Balcom and Green with my colleague Scott Grosskopf, also from our firm. We represent the Upper Yampa Water Conservancy District, the appellant in the case. The case before the court today presents, in our view, two legal issues affecting the ability of a municipal water provider to operate its water rights, various water rights for storage, in order to provide reliable supplies for its customers and its constituents. In this case, the municipal provider is a water conservancy district authorized and empowered by Colorado statute, political subdivision of the state of Colorado. The two issues that are presented for the court's consideration are related, in our view, by the principle in Colorado of maximum beneficial use of water. That relationship, we believe, is illustrated by the consideration of the operation of a municipal government's available supplies to serve its purposes, and also by the objective of having water available for those purposes during the time when the water is actually needed.
I actually couldn't understand from the briefs whether you have contracts for this extra amount of water you are attempting in this case to make absolute. That's what you're trying to do, right? Make absolute a body of water for, it seems from the brief, possible future delivery via augmentation or exchanges or contracts. Could you explain a little bit what those uses are that are contemplated, that are being used to firm up the conditional water rights?
The constraint on the answer, Justice Hobbs, is the limited record. There was no trial. And that's an important consideration for several.
What would you show if there were?
We would show, and we made an offer of proof that was abbreviated, that's in the record, that if allowed a trial, the district would show that it has contractual obligations and an augmentation plan by which it intends, through direct delivery or through the operation of its augmentation plan, to provide water to constituents who have entered a contract for either direct delivery or an augmentation plan from this reservoir, and that is a primary purpose of Stagecoach Reservoir being operated.
But was there anything in that offer of proof regarding the quantities that were committed to above the absolute water rights that the district already has?
No, there was not. The offer of proof was not specific to that point, Your Honor. And there was no trial with evidence of that sort presented.
Before you go on, could I ask you a question about that? I was a little confused about how we're here exactly. You're pointing out there was no trial. What was the nature of the motion and ruling down below and how this decision became final?
Well, and Justice Coates, the procedural status is important, we think, to understand, because there are a number of questions that can come up, and there is no record from which we can answer it or the state can answer it. The state opposers, the state and division engineers, filed a motion for summary judgment. And the court, water court, ultimately denied that motion, but in the process of doing so, made legal rulings as to the nature of the proof that the district would need to present at a trial in order to maintain its claim or prevail. And so it established two rules, legal rules, basically, that the district would be required to show, and this is a case in which the district has conditional water rights that it claims it diverted at its reservoir, and claims that that they were put to use or available for use, and therefore they should be absolute rather than conditional. And the court established in that, in regard to that claim, that unless the district could show it that those that it had diverted that water in excess of all of the absolute rights it already had, it could not prevail. And the district, the facts of the case were admitted that the district had not diverted in excess of the rate of other absolute water rights, and therefore the trial was futile. There was a confession of judgment on that point, but an objection to the legal ruling. The court also, it declined to make a couple of rulings, but it also ruled essentially that the water placed in the reservoir had to be placed to actual end uses by release, and the district objected to that. And so there are two critical legal rulings that prevented the district from going forward or made it futile for us to do so.
That's, so when you say you were not given a trial then, or not given the opportunity for a trial, in effect, you confessed as a result of the court's determination of what your burden would be. Is that right? Or?
Yes, the district affirmatively and voluntarily confessed that it could not meet the court's legal standards. And then the court denied the application.
So the procedural context then is not an appeal from summary judgment or appeal from ruling on issues of law, but instead, given the confessed judgment, this is a post-trial appeal. Is that correct?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It is an appeal from the legal determinations made by the court.
That judgment against you because you confessed in lieu of proceeding to trial. Correct?
And the appeal is from the legal rulings that made the trial futile, Your Honor.
I'm confused. I thought it was just simply based on your confession that it was a summary judgment motion that the trial judge granted. Is that wrong?
The judge actually denied...
Well, that was initially, but then you confessed, you filed a paper confessing based on his rulings, which you've just discussed, and then he granted the motion, right?
Yes, he
so this is an appeal
to the application.
So let's dismiss the application.
Yes.
So this is basically a summary judgment motion, right? As
yes.
opposed to what Justice Martinez, I mean, I'm confused. Maybe Justice Martinez is right that this is a post-judgment proceeding.
It may be. It's the first proceeding like this that I've actually been in procedurally, but it's an appeal from the legal rulings that prevented the district from attempting to prove its claim. The state, we believe, is arguing on these two points for limitations that would limit the district's flexibility in how it can divert from various sources and the conditions that it can enjoy in assuring it has future supplies available.
Well, the stream takes care of itself, right? I mean, the water remains in the stream until it can be appropriated, right? And isn't the fundamental issue here as to whether or not you have enough absolute water rights to serve the needs of the district now? I mean, isn't that the basic question?
The court made no findings about the district's needs.
This ties into the confession of judgment, I believe, because you have the right to, these were apparently changed from that four counties proposal that would have taken it over the mountains and put in Stagecoach Reservoir, which, you know, this is probably the one fill rule, right? You make absolute the water rights according to the law that you need to serve your committed needs. And didn't your confession say that you didn't need the extra amount of water, basically, to fill any purpose that can be presently identified as an actual beneficial use?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't characterize it that way. I think that the court set what we viewed as a mathematical test in order to fill this reservoir from these four, using these four counties' water rights, which were diverted, direct flow water rights downstream from the dam, changed up to the reservoir in the change proceeding. And twice before, the water court had made portions of these direct flow water rights absolute at Stagecoach Reservoir in prior cases. This is the third similar case. And the court said, unless the amount of rate of fill that you're claiming exceeds the 151 CFS you already made absolute on different rights, I'm not going to attribute the flow rate into the reservoir to your conditional rights. It wasn't really directed at a question of what the district needs in order to fill its reservoir or operate its reservoir for the district's purposes, because the evidence, the presentation to the court never got to that level. It was cut off by the mathematical conclusion that because the district had prior flow rate that hadn't been exceeded, the case couldn't go forward. There was no way to establish that the different water rights had been operated. And we believe that that is an inflexible and incorrect test when you have these types of water rights. So I've touched briefly on the background that the district has made the portions of these water rights absolute in the past in a similar way. It has the portfolio of water rights, and it has obviously been endeavoring to make them absolute over time in order to fill its reservoir. The court ordered that, as I said, unless the flow rate into the reservoir on the claim date at the claim time exceeded the amount made absolute in previous cases, the district could not prevail, and that putting water in the reservoir for future use would not allow it to have a beneficial use recognition either. The procedural status is important because we didn't get to the questions of how the district operates the reservoir, for what purpose it operates the reservoir, under what demand scenarios or hydrological conditions it operates the reservoir. Those things are not in the record because the mathematical test essentially cut the case off. We call the first issue the absolute's first principle. And it's not that's a principle that's been adopted by this court, but that is the articulated standard that was put forth by the State and Division Engineers and the court. In other words, that you need to use all of your absolute water rights if you hold a portfolio of conditional and absolute water rights. You have to maximally use all of your existing absolute rights before you can go into your portfolio and use a conditional water right. The original decree didn't contain that condition, the change decree. It said if you're going to use these water rights, the water has to be physically and legally available at the original point of diversion. And you have to have a way agreed to by the division engineer to make that determination that the water was physically and legally available in order to credit the use of the conditional water right. There was no absolutes first condition written into the change decree.
Well, isn't it implicit in Colorado law, though, that, I mean, you get a priority, you firm up your conditional water right, it's a true appropriation under the law, there's no true appropriation until you've put it to beneficial use. You'd agree with all that, right? So in a maximization scheme, optimization, which the water law is, others ought to have the opportunity to perfect water rights without having the conditional hang over their head if the district doesn't need them. So this relying on your absolute first, isn't that obviously the way you have to go? Because you don't get to exercising conditionals, you know, until you need it for beneficial use. Isn't that how the system operates?
I would agree with the basic principles you've articulated.
So you want to pick up a conditional that you don't really need because you have an absolute to fill that reservoir, or even for a recreational fill if it's decreed for that. And you want to pull in the conditional and firm that up, even though you don't need it. I mean, isn't that what you're proposing?
But you need to think through the implications, I think, on a case-by-case basis. that if the reservoir like Stagecoach or other reservoirs I could name around the state is limited by the physical water available at that dam site and the hydrology there, if you have two water rights and you choose to use one to fill it, mm-hmm. then you're not using the other one. If you use the other one, but not the first one, the draft of the overall reservoir remains the same. Mm-hmm. You don't get a double or triple fill. And I don't want to get into the one fill rule because we can, but the court specifically declined below to make a determination on a one fill argument, which is a one fill for a water right. You can have multiple water rights at a reservoir. But the use of one or two water rights is common for reservoirs and for ditches. And if you use one, you don't use the other, perhaps. And so it's right that you are not, that you do not waste water, you don't divert more than you need, you put it to beneficial use. But the requirement for going in sequence to your absolute rights first has not been an articulated principle in Colorado law. I mean, it has been historically that you can have conditional water rights and make them absolute, perhaps under a condition where you didn't use an absolute water right instead. And the implication from a statewide basis, you need to think through too. If a community has developed an in-basin water supply from the acquisition of long-term senior rights or whatever, but because of concerns to develop water for the future has gone to other basins, out-of-basin sources to develop conditional water rights. Is that municipality required to maximally use all of its in-basin supplies before it can begin to develop and utilize for the future it's out of basin water? The court's never articulated that as a requirement. But that's essentially what the absolute's first principle gets to, that any appropriator holding an absolute right or more than, you know, a portfolio of absolute and conditionals has to maximally use all of its absolutes before it can go to its conditionals, even if there would be no enlarged overall draft on the stream system. There's also the checks and balances in the system of historical use is going to be accredited to the water rights that are actually used and not to the ones that aren't. So you're not going to enlarge your absolute rights by declining to use them in preference to a conditional. That doesn't happen. So there are several checks and balances, Justice Hobbs, I believe, that preclude the overall problem of an enlarged draft or an enlarged portfolio over time. We believe that there is the test you've mentioned of need, et cetera. It's articulated for municipal governments now in the Fagosa cases that you've put forward. The court has also recognized for a long time that the test of ongoing need or non-speculative purpose arises in a conditional diligence case. So there are checks on conditional water rights when they're decreed, after they're decreed, as to whether they're needed. But never before, in my understanding, has the diversion of a conditional water right been conditioned on what the rest of your portfolio is. And go back through in that context a need test, just like when you come in for an augmentation plan to augment conditional water rights. There's not been a jurisprudence yet that says, well, before you can augment your conditional water rights, let's put them through a new needs test, you know, and see if you truly need them in the context of an augmentation plan. So we believe there are adequate checks in the system in the way the water rights work, in the way that the conditional water rights are tested, that the concerns articulated by the engineers would not materialize or can be circumscribed and limited. But it's not necessary in this case.
Counsel, can I stop you there just to follow up on an earlier question? So I guess you confess judgment, though, that if this absolute first position applied to you, you could not meet that burden. Is that correct?
Not on the facts that were available for the diversion of the conditional rights, no.
Okay.
That was clear.
Thank you.
So the bottom line we would present on the absolute first position is that the maximum beneficial use doctrine applicable to all water users, and that our client, the district, seeks to implement is served by having a diversification of sources of supply and allowing municipal governments to meet their obligations from a diverse source of supply and not limit them in the development of that supply to just using all of their absolutes before they can develop a conditional.
Can I ask one question just to clarify here? Maybe I'm just missing something, but are you making any distinction between the use of the water from these various sources? Are we discriminating what the beneficial use is, or in effect are you double counting the beneficial use, or does that make any sense?
We aren't intending to discriminate, no.
So in effect what you're saying is, even though you have an absolute right to water to meet your beneficial, the use to which you, your need, the beneficial use to which you put this water, in effect you should be able to count, you should be able to apply water used to that beneficial use to count it against a conditional water supply in order to make that absolute. Is that the thrust of the argument?
Yes, Your Honor. And to do that in preference to using your absolute right in order to achieve over time that diversified source basis for
the... So in effect, it comes down to saying once you've made a right absolute, you can hold in abeyance using that, putting it to a beneficial use, and you can, in effect, acquire more water for that same beneficial use?
Well, the acquisition of a new water right, this court has specifically said, contemplates what the existing supplies are. These are water rights that have been held by this district for 20 years. And the district is selected to use its conditional rights in this instance, or intended to, rather than its absolute rights. Now there's a historical use limitation then on the absolute rights, et cetera, but it's serving the same purpose. I would like to briefly touch on the other issue and then try and reserve some time for the reply. The second issue was whether placing water in the reservoir would entitle a beneficial use recognition, as had been achieved in the prior cases brought by the district for the same right. The state's position, in summary, is that no, 100 years of jurisprudence tell us that you have to actually drain your reservoir completely and apply it to every decreed use before you get an absolute use recognition. And we believe that that is contrary to the reason for storage, and the offer of proof says we would provide this, you know, for augmentation purposes. That really no one who's running a municipal water system ever really wants to fully drain their municipal reservoir. They hold it for the future, for drought. Now there was no developed record on this though. And so, you know, I'm not arguing from a developed record. I'm arguing from basic principles. So we believe that the theory of the case going forward, or the better articulated rule than that that the water court, it pronounced or applied in this case, would be that the storage of water under certain conditions for future use can be recognized as a beneficial use. And it depends on a case-by-case determination, which your jurisprudence has said beneficial use is case-by-case. And you have recognized that even in some instances where no one even intends to use water, drilling a gas well, digging a gravel pit, that those are beneficial use, even though there's no affirmative intent. Here we have an intent to use, is reflected in the decrees, but not an immediate use, a storage. We've drawn the analogy of whether you have to have your barn or your house burn before you can get a fire protection water right made absolute. We think that that's similar to many municipal programs who are trying to augment for drought conditions. And we suggest flexibility in a case-by-case determination. And ultimately that the water court would need to go back and look at, through a trial, the district's demand scenarios, its purposes in operating this reservoir and its operations as to how it intends to meet its demand scenarios and how the hydrological limitations would fit into all of that. And that is not a developed record or matters yet considered by the water court. With that, I would appreciate reserving my remaining time, if there are no more questions, for a reply to the engineer's position.
You do that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? No. Okay. Counsel?
May it please the court, I'm John Siren, First Assistant Attorney General for the Water Rights Unit at the Colorado Attorney General's Office, representing the state and the Division of Engineers. And as Mr. Halford explained, this matter concerns EPA AMPA's application to make certain water rights absolute, certain conditional water rights absolute. Prior to granting Upper Yampa these new absolute water rights, the Water Court asked Upper Yampa to prove two things. First, it asked Upper Yampa to prove that it needed more absolute water rights above its existing water supply. And second, it asked Upper Yampa to prove that it had not simply stored water, that it had applied water to actual beneficial use. Now today, Upper Yampa is arguing that the Water Court didn't have authority to ask Upper Yampa to prove those two things, that it didn't have authority to ask Upper Yampa to prove that it needed more absolute water rights or that it had applied water to actual beneficial use. But those arguments are simply contrary to the law. It's a fundamental principle of Colorado water law that in order to get a water right, you have to prove a need. And this court has held multiple times that when you're looking at whether a water user has a need, you look at a water user's ability to use an existing water supply. And second, it's a fundamental principle of Colorado water law that in order to make a water right absolute, you have to apply it to beneficial use. And this court has held multiple times that simply storing water is not application to beneficial use. You have to actually apply the water to beneficial use.
Well, there's a caveat on that, is there not? I mean, when the in-stream flow law was adopted in 1973, storage for recreation in the reservoir was recognized as a beneficial use.
That's correct, Your Honor. Although I wouldn't see that as an exemption. I would see that that's an actual application, because when you stored the water in the reservoir, you've also placed it to use, because you've created a recreation environment. Just like in fishing, when you store water in the reservoir, you can say you put it to use because you created a fish habitat. So those circumstances, for me, would be examples of in-place uses. So that you've actually stored the water and you've placed it to beneficial use. But I would agree, the water did not have to be released in that circumstance.
But one doesn't have to be released.
It has to be released when that release is necessary to apply it to beneficial use. For example,
other than the piscatorial recreation unit.
Exactly. For example, in this court's very early Highland Ditch case, this court decided in 1912 that water had to be not just stored, but applied to beneficial use. It's interesting that Upper Yampa never even addresses that case or any of this other case law that's really clear on this point. But in that case, it was an irrigation use, and the water court said it had to be released and used for irrigation in order to apply the water to beneficial use. So for me, we actually have really clear law here on these two points, which is somewhat unusual.
Counsel, can I stop you there? When you say, I think we have clear law that says that you have to show need, but do we have clear law that says that you look at a water user's entire portfolio to determine that need? But we haven't said that before, have we?
Well, we have said, you have said, in those cases, that in order to determine whether a water user has a need for a conditional water right, you should look at its existing demand and its existing supply and its ability to use its existing supply. So certainly this court has said, yes, you should consider the water user's ability to use its existing supply. Similarly, in the Thornton v. Bijou case, and I think this case is interesting because, jumping ahead of the game a little bit, APAMPA says, well, you should look at demand when you're getting a new water right, but then later you don't need to look at demand later down the road. But Thornton v. Bijou was actually, and in the Oxy cases, you said that's not correct, that you continue to look at a water user's need for a conditional water right all down the line. And in the Thornton v. Bijou case, this court approved of the water court continuing to look at the water user's needs for its conditional water rights and evaluating that need against its existing supply.
Right, but I mean, I guess we never evaluated a conditional right and said, ah, you have an absolute right, you can't make your conditional right absolute.
And that is where the rubber hits the road today.
Correct, and that's where I want you to focus. Tell me why should we impose that requirement that if you want to turn your conditional right into an absolute right, we have to look back to all your absolute rights to determine need. Help me understand why we should impose that requirement.
You know, I would, rather than say imposing a requirement, I guess I would say the question is whether you should exempt a water user who's making a water right absolute from the requirement that he show that he has a need. Because at every other step in the procedure, in the procedure of getting a conditional water right, you have to demonstrate that you have a need. You have to demonstrate a need at the beginning when you apply for the water right, then you have to show you need the water right above your existing supply. And this court has said, though, that when you get a conditional water right, your need for that may change over time. It said, again, in both the Oxy cases and the Thornton v. Bijou case, that only time could determine whether all, a part, or none of a claimed conditional right is actually needed. And the court in Bijou said, a continued evaluation is necessary to correct inaccuracies in the original projection and to make sure that the amount that's finally made absolute is actually consistent with your needs. So you have held all along the line in the original application and then in each diligence proceeding, the water court has to show that it has a need for the water right. What APAMPA is asking you to do is to drop the ball at the most important stage when you're actually making the water right absolute and sort of turn a blind eye at that stage to whether or not the original projections were inaccurate or whether or not they actually now have a demand for the water right. And I think that it just doesn't make sense for this court to decide to exempt a water user from this analysis at the most important stage when the water is actually taken out of the system and given as an absolute water right to a water user. I think that's really the stage that you really need to make sure that the water user still has that conditional, that right that has changed over time. Now, this is my opinion and the engineer's opinion, but it's not just our opinion. Every water court that's considered this issue has reached that same conclusion. The Division 6 Water Court held that you need to make this analysis because it's necessary in order to curb speculative hoarding and ensure that water is available to those with actual need. As Justice Hobbs pointed out, once a water right is made absolute, while it's conditional, the water user can still, in their needs analysis, disregard it. Once it's absolute, it's not that easy to disregard the water user. So in other words, making these rights absolute does take it away from other water users. Anyway, the Division 6 Water Court said that it's appropriate to consider this continued need in order to curb speculative holding and ensure that water is available to those with actual need. The Division 5 Water Court case held that not exempting this analysis at the most critical stage is important because doing so satisfies the intent of the legislator, promotes maximum utilization of the waters as a state, protects vested water rights from injury, and preserves the unappropriated waters of the state for water users with legitimate need for water. And in similar, Judge Berman in Division 1, I think he put it perhaps most simply when he said, if you're claiming new water rights and you already have existing water rights, you have to provide an explanation of why didn't you divert your existing rights? Why didn't you divert those rights and instead turn to the new rights?
Sorry, can I just ask you a question? To further up on what you're explaining, wouldn't that require some evidentiary matter to make that determination that you just said, Judge Berman?
And that's a good question. And let me jump into this kind of fray that you guys discussed, which is, you know, what is the procedural status? This was decided on a motion for summary judgment, but in that motion, Upper Yampa had the ability to prevent any evidence they thought was relevant. And then in their offer of proof, they again had the opportunity to produce evidence that they thought was relevant. They never produced any evidence that that the water, the 108 CFS that's at issue in this case, could not have been diverted under their existing water rights. They never produced that evidence, and they never produced evidence that their existing water rights weren't available for any reason. Now, we would agree, the state engineers would agree, that if they couldn't use their existing water rights for some reason, and it was so, it was necessary for them to manage their supply to
instead. What kinds of reasons would you say that that was appropriate?
Well, for example, in this case, we have 1,700 some CFS of water rights that were decreed to a number of tributaries to the Yampa River. Those water rights were all moved to the Stagecoach Reservoir. Now, it's a little confusing because this was back in the day, they didn't actually turn them into volumetric. They left them at CFS limits. But one limitation on each of these water rights was you can only divert these at Stagecoach if they're available at their original point. So if they're dry at the original point, you can't divert them. So if it had been the case that their existing water rights were dry at their original point of diversion, then they could have turned to their other water rights. But they have something like 1,700 CFS of water rights here.
But it seems to me that you're explaining something other than sort of the notion that there might be a reason for them not to use their absolute rights. Instead, under the scenario you just gave, they don't really have the absolute right under those circumstances. Isn't that correct?
I would say they don't have the absolute. They do have the absolute right. They're not able to use it at that point in time. It's not available to them. So if that water right is not available to them, then they would have.
Are there other circumstances where they might make a choice about whether to use all of the absolute rights before turning to the conditional rights, a choice which is not commanded by
example,
conditions of law?
Excuse me, sir. Another example might be where these water rights are decreed for different purposes, that the water rights they need water for, say, domestic purposes. Their existing water rights are decreed for municipal or for firefighting or something along those lines. Then they would say, we can't use our existing water rights. We need to divert these other conditional water rights. That would be another example.
Would that circumstance meet the requirements of the water court's order, which indicated that they had to show that they diverted and put to beneficial use water in excess of their absolute rights?
Well, in this case, all of these water rights are decreed for the same purposes. There's no issue about purposes, and there was no issue that one of the water rights wasn't available. As I said, the facts are undisputed that these water rights could have been diverted under their existing, their new water rights could have been diverted under their existing absolute water rights. So given that, the water court didn't consider that issue because it wasn't presented to the water court. That was not the facts of this case. I think if the facts had been different here, and again, if the facts had been different, Upper Yampa had the opportunity to present that in the response to the motion for summary judgment. It had the opportunity to present those different facts in the confession of judgment. It didn't do that.
Let me return you or sort of refocus on the procedural status here, because it seems to me to reflect on what we're talking about. And that is, obviously Upper Yampa is trying to appeal these rulings of law, and you've actually responded as if what's at issue is whether the water court's rulings of law are correct. It's kind of an odd approach to it, though, because, as you know, the water court actually denied summary judgment motion, and then they subsequently made an offer of proof, which apparently wasn't involved in the summary judgment motion and denial, and then they confessed judgment. It's unclear what judgment they confessed. Maybe they intended to confess summary judgment, but that's sort of an odd context in terms of what facts are available to us, and if there are edges, if you will, if there are if the water court's ruling is maybe subject to some exceptions or some qualification based on other factual circumstances, there seems to be little room for that in the manner in which this is presented to us. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts at all about the procedural context. Is this an appeal from a summary judgment order that in effect is granted because of the confession?
I would have to say, that's a tough question. And I would say it's very close to that, if that's not what it is.
The tougher question is probably, does it matter?
And I guess that's really where I would want to go. Justice Bender suggested that actually it's a ruling on the trial. You suggested it's a ruling on the summary judgment. And I think it's really something along the lines of both of those, in that we know what the facts are. The facts have been presented in the motion for response to the motion for summary judgment and in the confession of judgment, and now we're applying the law to those facts. So given the facts before us, what is the correct ruling? And that's what the court...
And I totally understand. I just want to ask one more question about that. I understand everyone wants to be on the substance of this. But have you even thought about, can you appeal from a confessed judgment? I mean... you haven't presented there yet, but hasn't presented any contest.
I think we have to accept, for this appeal, we accept the facts in the confession of judgment as being true, and we can say, based on those facts, can they prevail? So yes, I would say yes, you can. And we agreed to Upper Yampa doing this confession of judgment because we firmly believe that based on these confessed facts and the law, they cannot prevail. Based on the facts that they could have diverted this water under their existing water rights.
So it might be best viewed that this is somewhat of an agreement that summary judgment based on the court's legal rulings would be granted based on the facts here, including the offer of proof subsequent to the summary judgment order.
I would agree to that, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you see any other exceptions? Any other exceptions to the absolute first rule?
Those are the two that come to mind. We've discussed this issue with the state engineer, and those are two obvious examples. And those are situations where we say, you have a reason for using a different water right. But those, again, are not presented here. In fact...
So we ought not to reach too far here. Let me, this second issue,
yes,
about when you can prove up an absolute based on release. I'm a little concerned about the implications of that argument. The Conservancy Act is invoked here. As you know, there's a compensatory reservoir sitting on the West Slope, Green Mountain Reservoir. The water wasn't used for years and years and years. In fact, it's just being placed to use that was set aside for the West Slope to use. I'm just using that as an example. So how do you square those kinds of efforts that have to be made to utilize Colorado's water as a whole, yet still provide for the needs of a basin, with your idea here that there actually has to be an absolute release of every increment before you can get an absolute right for that pool of future water?
Very carefully.
Uses. You're going to answer very carefully, you're going to say how to proceed very carefully.
You square it up very carefully, I guess.
Could you attempt to do that?
And that is, I apologize, Ron. I guess what I'm trying to do is recognize the difficulty that you're raising. And it is a difficult question. There's a line between, can you make a reservoir absolute where you haven't released and used any of the water, to... So you have to wait until every single last drop is taken out of the reservoir. And where that line is drawn, I guess I'd have to say, you know, realistically, as a practical matter, in most cases, somebody will say, yeah, most of the water was used, that's good enough. And that's how it really works practically. You know, and that's, so it's hard for me to say, yeah, every last drop of water has to be released from the reservoir before it can be made absolute. Because I don't think practically that's how it's going to play out. But on the other hand, it's been real clear that a water user has to use water before it can make that water right absolute. And in this case, none of this water was released for domestic, municipal, or augmentation purposes. There might have been a release for power. There might have been some use in site for recreational purposes, as you pointed out, Justice Hobbs. But This water has not been released for domestic municipal uses. So, I mean, what Upper Yampa seems to be asking is that we need a ruling that the mere storage of making water available for later use is a use. And this court has already said that that's not the case. The water has to be applied to actual beneficial use. So I guess I am struggling a bit to draw a really clear line that you would like me to draw, and I don't have a really bright line answer for that.
Could you talk a little bit about storage when it's applied to a beneficial use, and what really what I'm after is what within a reasonable time means in consideration of the various reservoirs portfolio and so forth? How do we think about that? I mean, I know that's what our case law says, but what does that mean?
I guess I would have to do that on a case-by-case basis and look at what...
Know it when you see it?
You know it when you see it, yes, sir. And you'd have to look at what type of use it was decreed for and what would be reasonable for that type of use. If it was decreed for domestic use for a project that was supposed to be in operation within a couple of years, and it was never used there, and they had some other water supply, that would be an example where they didn't really have a need for this water for that project. And I think there you can say, you know, this water has not been applied in a reasonable time. It doesn't look like it's ever going to be applied. On the other hand, Mr. Halford pointed out, for municipal water supply, you do have a much longer plan schedule, and you're going to need to have water in storage for a long period of time. You know, one thing I'd like to touch on is the fact that a water right is not made absolute does not mean the water right's gone. And that's one of really what I see Mr. Halford's arguments boiling down to is a complaint about the diligence requirement. It's they're saying the engineers, the water court is preventing us from managing our water supply by preventing us from using our conditional water rights, preventing us from making these water rights absolute. But nobody's preventing that from happening. All the water court is saying is that you have to maintain diligence until you've actually shown a need and you've actually put this water to use. You can continue to manage your water supply, you can continue to keep these water rights available for your use, but you have to maintain diligence. Now, Upper Yampa argues, well, you know, diligence is hard and we have to make these proofs and everything. And yeah, that's true, but that's the law. That's what the decision the General Assembly made was that in order to keep a conditional water right, you have to maintain diligence on that water right. And for us to simply say, well, yeah, you usually have to maintain diligence, but in these circumstances, we're going to just let it go.
After they build the reservoir, what's the diligence for a municipality?
6 years.
I know that, but I mean as a practical matter, what do they have to show?
They would have to show that they're continuing to develop their infrastructure, that they're continuing to grow.
Oh, I mean, they built it, so it's done.
They built it.
They finished it. But they have to get users. They have to develop contractees, like, as they point out.
That's right.
So what do they show for diligence?
They can show an effort to obtain contractees. They can show that they've signed up contractees. They can show that they've continued to store water and to make it later available in the future. They can show that the city continues to grow, that this likely water will be needed in the future. They can show that their other water supplies are drawing down. They can show that that they've actually expanded the size of their city and it's likely to be more water needed in the future. I think they can show a lot of things to demonstrate that they have a continued need, a continued ability to use this water. But simply saying, you know what, it's too hard for us to do that and therefore we shouldn't have to maintain diligence doesn't seem to me to be consistent with the law. And I think if there is a real problem for them to continue to make this demonstration, the proper avenue for them would be to, in the diligence proceeding, saying, listen, we've done everything we can, we can't do any more, and the court could consider it at that time. But I don't think the proper avenue for them is to say, well, let's just lift the diligence requirement.
Okay.
So before you move on, can I just follow up on the storage question? If just assume we agree with you on this, you showing absolutes are insufficient as part of the need demonstration, we agree with you on that, do we actually have to reach whether storage is, you know, that draw the line between mere storage and storage for a beneficial use?
I would agree that you do not have to reach that question. You do not have to, not only do you not have to draw exactly where the line is, we don't have to touch that question at all, because the first question resolves the issue. The fact that the water, it would be nice to be able to solve that second question. It would be nice for all of us.
Yeah.
But it's not something we have to do today. What we do have to do today is determine whether or not a water user has to demonstrate a continued need for its water right, not only when it applies for it and makes it, it goes through its diligence proceedings, but also when it makes, at the final stage, when it makes a water right absolute.
Thank you.
Can I, since we use that terminology about what we have to decide today, I'm still a little bit concerned about the procedural posture here and why we're here on appeal. Is there just a little bit of a flavor here of, I won't use the word collusion, but let's say a contrived lawsuit in which you all want an answer to an abstract question, and you've in effect set up the question and then confessed to dismiss the case, so we'll decide it at this point without any actual factual record here?
I can guarantee you, and I'm sure Mr. Alford would back me up, that is not the case. That there was a real dispute between the parties on this issue.
But I understood your answers. You sort of hedged on answering whether this was, in effect, if not in name, in effect, a granting of a motion for summary judgment. And if that would not have been required, then it seems to me we are in the funny posture here in which you've got a confession to dismiss an application. Don't even seem to have an application denied. It's a confession to dismiss an application so that you can get a determination without going through a trial or other factual presentation. You can get a determination about what the judge thought the law was on a particular point.
I guess I'd first say that the reason I hedged is I didn't know the answer to the question. I think, as everybody here has indicated, it's a little confusing procedurally, and it's to me one of those situations that doesn't fall neatly into a box, so I couldn't give you the exact answer. I can just say what I think is occurring here. So
given the facts as you all seem to agree to them, if not formally stipulated to them, do you believe the judge erred in not granting a motion for summary judgment? That's what he should have done, and in effect, that is what he did?
Perhaps he did err in that if the facts were undisputed based on the motion for summary judgment, that the water could have been diverted under Upper Yampa's existing water rights, and summary judgment was appropriate. But it appears to me that what the water court did is sort of give Upper Yampa a second chance to say, can you show me this? Can you show me that you actually diverted more than 151 CFS, that you actually needed more absolute water rights? And Upper Yampa said, well, you know, we can't. And based on that, so in a sense, it's sort of the summary judgment motion where the court gave Upper Yampa one last chance and Upper Yampa couldn't satisfy it. So in that sense, you could say the summary judgment motion was granted.
Or he simply dismissed the applications for absolute water rights and left them in the conditional water rights status, whatever was left on the diligence periods for, why isn't it just tantamount to a dismissal of the applications?
And I guess I would agree that is exactly what it is. It's a dismissal of the application based on the judge's view of the facts, of the law, and the undisputed facts. And again, there is no thought of collusion here. We would have been happy to go to trial. Upper Yampa had said, well, we think that we know we can't prove that we diverted this on more than 151 CFS, so why go to trial? And we agreed with that. But no collusion here. We did disagree on both the facts and mainly the law. Any other questions?
Well, I'm just curious about the whole factual background of this four counties appropriation that has now been converted. Now, that was an out-of-basin, front range kind of situation. That's been converted and tried to be put in a basin that has very little demonstrable growth, absent claims like oil shale, which were dismissed and haven't been revived. Are we trying to fit, you know, a project that no longer exists into a project for this basin that doesn't have the need? I mean,
well, that very well might be the case, and that's why it's, to me, incredibly important that we continue to evaluate whether there's a need for these 1,700 CFS of conditional water rights in basin, because it very may well be the case that there isn't a continued need for this, all of this water.
And the need can develop incrementally. That is the water law, after all.
The need can develop incrementally, and the need can be shown over time, and diligence can be maintained until that needs to develop. But to just simply grant it now seems to be making these water rights absolute when we don't have any evidence that they're actually going to be needed. And under the approach taken by Upper Yampa, it's not simply this 108 CFS this year. They could each year, most of these water rights are about 30 or 40 CFS. Each year, or even each day, they could choose to divert a different water right and make that different water right absolute. As a result, we get 1,700 or 1,500, whatever CFS, I'm just saying, depending on how much they're able to do, of water absolute, even though there's never been shown a need for that much water. That's why, to me, the court should not exempt them from this requirement that applies in all other circumstances, that you continue to show a need. One last point on this. I'm interesting about this Four Counties case. There actually was a Supreme Court case that addressed the Four Counties' rights previously when they originally decreed. And it was a review of the original conditional appropriation for the Four Counties' rights. This court reviewed that original appropriation, and it approved the conditional appropriation, but it said, it specifically stated that no absolute decree would be awarded, quote, until the water is put to beneficial use, and then only for such amount as put to such use. So this court has even said about these water rights, you can only make them absolute when you've actually, for the amount that you've put to use.
You're out of time. Appreciate it. You used your time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel?
I'd like to begin by assuring the court that the district did not invite these issues. The engineers came forward with their legal position, and it was resisted contentiously.
Counsel, I guess we're sort of beating this procedural horse, but what would normally happen, I think, is if the judge would deny a motion for summary judgment, give you an opportunity to come up with some additional facts, you would provide the facts, and then the judge would say, based upon those facts, you're taking those facts as true, there still is no question of fact, no question of law, and I'm going to grant the motion for summary judgment. And I was just looking again at the second order issued by the judge here, and he seems to be taking the position that what happened was he denied the motion for summary judgment, gave you the additional opportunity to come up with facts. You probably did so, but then you filed a confession of judgment, sort of saying that it was your opinion based upon these facts that you weren't going to win. And then the judge said, okay, well, the case is over. The application is denied. But there never was a ruling at all. It was almost as if you preempted the judge's second step. Is that not right? By firing this confession of judgment?
We confessed that we could not meet the legal test.
Right, which amounted in... Right,
be a factual basis on which the court would grant the application within the legal framework he had established.
Excuse me, but normally what you would do is not so much confess that, but come up with your facts and then let the judge make that legal determination. So, and then based upon that, deny your motion for an application or motion for summary judgment. It was like, I think that's what we're all struggling with. It was as you took the case away from the judge by confessing that you couldn't meet the standards here, and that's what makes it so hard for us to figure it out.
And the court certainly agreed with that approach by entering the order of denial of this application.
It would deny the application because you had confessed it. There was nothing else for him to do. It's tantamount to withdrawing your application.
We certainly haven't viewed it that way, but if you choose to view it that way, I guess there are ramifications for whether you decide anything. But it is true, and I want to clarify, that the water rights were not canceled. The water rights came through the door to get to the issues I'd like to rebut. They came through the door in the water court with a existing diligence determination, which includes implicitly a finding that they're needed, that they're feasible, et cetera. And the request was whether they had been diverted so they could be made absolute. And the state's position is that every step of the way, even though they came in with that reality check that, you know, you have it in the original proceeding for the water right, you have it in a diligence proceeding, they came through the door with that there should have been then again been a check as to whether they were needed. And the district, Mr. Siren elaborated about what the district was given the opportunity to prove and what it didn't, that there were excuses.
Counsel, but that gets right to my point, is that you were given an opportunity to prove virtually anything you wanted, the way I'm reading the court's first order. That's why he denied the motion for summary judgment. He basically said exactly what counsel for the attorney general said. Please come back and tell me what this case is all about. And you didn't do that. You're telling us that you weren't given this opportunity to do it, but you didn't do it. For whatever reason, you confessed instead.
We had the opportunity. We confessed that there were no excuses. It is not the district's position that it has to have excuses as to why it operated these water rights. It's the district's position that it has a diversified portfolio of viable existing conditional water rights and absolute water rights, and it can utilize its conditional water rights in preference to its absolute rights to fill its reservoir. We didn't try to make excuses, and it wasn't our position that we had to make excuses. And so we believe that the court erred in, for the first time, saying you have to use all your absolutes before you use your any conditional.
Thank you very much. You're out of time. Any further questions, though? All right. Now, let me clarify Justice Marquez's possible participation in these cases arguing today. She, of course, will have to decide whether or not she wants to disqualify herself. I didn't mean to imply that she is going to, but that she would be eligible to participate in any of these cases starting with today's arguments if she determines to when she takes the bench. Okay? So we'll deem this case submitted. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll stand in recess for